Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to another episode of If You Love This Planet. Today my guest is Paul Collins, an Australian historian, broadcaster and writer. Paul holds a master's degree in theology from Harvard University, a doctorate in philosophy in history from the Australian National University, and is a fellow of the Trinity College of Music in the UK. Paul has taught history and theology in Australia, the US and Pacific countries, and worked as a parish priest in Sydney, Hobart and Tasmania. Paul Collins is well known as a commentator on Catholicism and the papacy, with a strong interest in environmental and population issues. His book, God's Earth, About Religion and Ecology, has been made into a major TV documentary by the ABC here in Australia. He is the author of 11 books, the most recent being Believers, Does the Catholic Church in Australia Have a Future?, published by the University of New South Wales, which has just been published. In March 2001, he resigned from the active priestly ministry of the Catholic Church after 33 years' service due to a doctrinal dispute with the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith over his book Papal Power, published in 1997. Nowadays, he works as a freelance writer, speaker, and broadcaster on environmental issues, social ethics, theology, history, and media. And interestingly, he was the main commentator in Australia on the Pope's recent visit here in Sydney. Paul Collins, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Helen.
Paul, first, I do want to first ask you a personal thing. What caused you to resign, and what was the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and your book Papal Power?
Well, it's a fairly straightforward story, a story that many people, or not many, but a number of people have experienced, including a number of U.S. Catholics. I wrote a book in 1997, published by HarperCollins, called Papal Power, as you mentioned. And not long after it was published, I received a letter from the general, the boss of the religious order to which I belonged. And he had received, he said, a letter from what's known as the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. Essentially, what this is the old Inquisition. The Inquisition actually has gone through two reincarnations. It was the Roman Inquisition up until 1903, then it became the Holy Office, and it was renamed in the early 1970s as the Congregation, in other words, the Committee of Cardinals, who supervised the doctrine of the Church. So these are the characters that keep an eye on doctrinal orthodoxy. So Papal Power, the book, got into trouble with this Committee of Cardinals, this department of the Vatican. Essentially, it led to the then boss of that department, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, writing me a letter telling me that there were a number of things in my book which, if I didn't correct, I would be condemned. Now, since most of the material in the book was, was nothing spectacularly heretical about it, and it was largely about the internal government of the Church, and particularly the papacy, I said that I was not willing. But I knew that by picking a real ongoing fight with Ratzinger and the congregation, I'd be really placing the religious order to which I belonged in a very difficult position. So I thought that discretion was the better part of valor. So I resigned from the active ministry, but I'm still very much an active Catholic who plays, I think, a very active role in the Church in Australia. would be well known to all of the bishops of Australia, and I count quite a number of them as personal friends. So I'm still very much an active, participative member of the Catholic Church.
Well, what about Ratzinger, who is now the present Pope? Do you have any relationship with him, or is there any hard feelings between you, or how did that end up, Paul?
Well, no, I'm a realist, Helen, in some ways my book, went out there and led with a right hook to the chin, so I was prepared to go out there and say things in public which were being discussed in private in the church, but which the Vatican really didn't want to be said in public about church government. And so we have a wonderful expression on Australia, if you do something like that, well, in the end, you've got to cop it sweet. That is, you've got to accept the consequences of your action. Mm. And so I personally, in some ways, while I actually don't think that Benedict the 16th is going to be a particularly impressive pope, I think personally, and I had the chance to see him just 2 weeks ago in Sydney during World Youth Day, when I say see him, I saw him from some distance, probably about 6 or 7 metres away. I think he is essentially a very spiritual man, a man of a complete integrity and sincerity, and I certainly respect him as a leading theologian of a quite conservative kind, but nevertheless a leading theologian. So, no, there are no hard feelings, and it's just life, really, and at 67, almost 68, you get used to these things.
Well, that's right. This is Paul Collins, who is actually an ex-priest in the Catholic Church. Paul, when you resigned, did you have any grief about leaving the active ministry of the Church?
The actual dispute started in 1997, and my resignation came in 2002. Mm. It's been interesting to reflect on that. People often ask me that question. The truth is, I didn't feel any great feeling of loss. In fact, I think what has happened is that it was probably the right decision, because it's taken me in the direction of still participating very much in the life of the church, but in some ways has given me a freedom to be able to say things and to speak out even more than I had when I was a priest. Mm. And so for me, it's been quite a freeing experience, and I've subsequently married a woman who's been a friend of mine for many years, a woman whose husband I knew before he died, and we just decided that being lonely in the late 60s was not the best thing to do, and I think that I've also had that freedom then to marry someone whom I really do love. So that's been good as well.
Oh, that's wonderful. Wonderful, Paul. Well, now, we talked earlier before we started the interview about the environment, and you talked about environmental conversion. I'm not quite sure what you mean by that, because I guess I've always been an environmentalist because I'm a biologist and a physician, and it's so obvious to me what's happening. But can you talk about your notion of environmental conversion?
Yes, well, I haven't always been an environmentalist. Some 2 decades ago, I spent 7 years living in the United States. The first couple of years was when I was at Harvard University, so I was living in Boston. But after that, I went back to the United States and was teaching there, teaching theology and, ministry with the Dominican sisters in a small town called Adrian in southeastern Michigan. I think my environmental conversion began in Michigan insofar as I saw the consequences of industrialization, of vast industrialization, and I'm talking here specifically about the car industry, the motor industry, but not just the auto industry, but also a lot of the other kind of polluting industries that particularly surrounded the southern part of the Great Lakes. And so, for the first time in my life, my eyes were opened in Michigan. I saw the consequences of industrialization on a very considerable scale. But what that did was that it actually cast my mind back to an experience that I'd had many years before in Australia. I was living at the time on the island of Tasmania, the island state to the south of Australia. And again, probably one of the most unique lakes in the world, Lake Pedder, was kind of scheduled for destruction by a vast dam in order to create hydroelectricity. And I went into Lake Pedder. I walked into Lake Pedder about 6 months before it was drowned. And I suddenly realized, even then as a quite young man, I was only, I think, 30 at the time, that here was this magnificent, absolutely transfixingly beautiful place that was going to be destroyed to supply unneeded hydroelectricity in a state that is one of the most, in a place that's one of the most beautiful in the world, and yet wanted to industrialize itself. And so those that experience of beauty and industrialization juxtaposed kind of came together for me, particularly after I left the States and came back to Australia, and I suddenly started to see the environment in a way that I'd never seen it before. I suppose I was in my late 40s at the time. And I think what happened to me was a real conversion, that a conversion kind of parallel to a religious conversion, that suddenly I saw the world with different eyes. My imagination was opened. My way of viewing the physical reality around me was changed. I started to see the colors. I started to see the beauty of the sky and the vastness of the sky. I started to see Australian animals that I'd really never adverted to, because I'd grown up in a city, in the city of Melbourne, right in central Melbourne. And so I had no sense of this bigger, greater, more beautiful world. And that for me was, you know, a real conversion. And I've talked to environmentalists and to many people in the green movement, and you don't have to be a religious person to undergo that kind of environmental conversion. Many people in the environmental movement have kind of been through a similar experience, and who in fact now view the world as a manifestation of the non-human, of something that transcends the human. I'd call, you know, that God. But you don't even have to be a believer in God to believe that the natural world transcends the human, is greater than the human, you know, lends a kind of an imaginative diversity to the human if we didn't have it, it would seem to me we would be far less human. We would be kind of, our imaginations would become completely stultified, and we wouldn't be able to think of anything except the kind of the human, and we'd become trapped in a kind of anthropocentrism, which I think is, in the end, quite destructive of genuine humanity.
Yes. I'm talking to Paul Collins, who is an ex-Catholic priest, and he talked then about his conversion to environmentalism. It's clear to me, Paul, that you had an epiphany in Tasmania at Lake Pedder, which is I think it's a spiritual conversion for me. I don't actually believe in God, but for me, nature is sacred, and I guess I'd call myself a pantheist after the god Pan, who worshipped nature, and for me, that's absolutely everything. I suppose as more and more people get in touch with that, and everyone needs to, then you realize what we need to do to save the planet. But tell us about what you actually saw in Michigan due to the auto industry, Paul, when you lived there.
Well, I saw what happened to towns like Flint. I mean, Michael Moore comes, the filmmaker and the controversialist, comes from Flint, Michigan. I saw, you know, whole towns and small cities, you know, tied to one industry. I saw people's whole lives assumed by the corporations that control these industries. I saw the pollution of, I mean, as an Australian, you appreciate water because we are so short of water on such a dry continent. Here I was, just south of the Great Lakes, you know, literally floating on water, so much water. And yet that water table was being polluted by the chemicals that were being used not only to make cars, but also to make refrigerators, also to make weapons of destruction. I just simply saw a landscape devastated by industry. Subsequent to that, I've seen even worse landscapes. For instance, when we were making the documentary on God's Earth, we actually went up to the Aral Sea in Uzbekistan in Central Asia, and we filmed there at the Aral Sea, and there's a famous kind of scene at the Aral Sea where these rather large fishing boats are simply sitting in the middle of the desert because the sea has retreated. And I mean, I saw there the consequences of the misuse of water, the drying up of one of the largest freshwater lakes in the world, now a third of its original size, and all that has happened in the last 50 to 60 years, all as a result of cotton growing, irrigation in a dry landscape, and also the experimentation that went on in that area by the Soviets with weapons, with poison gases of weapons of various sorts. And not only did I see the landscape devastated, and talking to the environmentalists who struggle with all of the difficulties of a place like Uzbekistan, who struggle to try to represent the environment, telling me that this used to be a vast swamp in which there was a specific subspecies of the Asian tiger. And the last of that subspecies died in the 1960s. So when you kind of see those things, when you see animals, whole species of animals or subspecies destroyed by human activity of the most monumentally stupid sort, I tend to become, I suppose, pretty angry about it. But it also makes you determined to do something about it, and I think that for me, increasingly, my spirituality, which certainly centers both on the world and the environment, but also centers very much on the Christian and specifically the Catholic tradition, I can fairly easily hold those two things together. I also think that there's a kind of an asceticism that flows from that, which I'm sure you know about because of your own courage and bravery in standing up on the nuclear issue. There's a kind of an asceticism built into environmental commitment. If you're converted to the environment, then it's got to flow forth in action to save the environment and in a willingness to stand up to the powers that be.
Yes. I'm talking to Paul Collins. He's a Catholic priest from Australia. Paul, then on that note, can you extrapolate into where the Catholic Church stands on the environment now and what they could be doing, should be doing, and have done and haven't done?
Well, the Catholic Church is, of course, famous for the whole question of contraception. And in some ways, I personally, and I know that the vast majority of Catholics in developed countries, including the United States, consider the contraception decision something of a disaster. And they show that they consider it a disaster by simply ignoring it. You certainly, without any doubt, the vast majority of Catholics, practicing Catholics, I mean, in countries like the United States or Canada or Australia or Britain, are simply using contraception. The evidence for that is quite overwhelming. So the decision really, in some ways, has become an embarrassment to the Catholic Church. But that embarrassment then tends to be compounded when there is a refusal to come to grips with the HIV/AIDS epidemic, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, but also in other parts of the world, for instance, even close to Australia, in a place like Papua New Guinea or in the Pacific Islands. Despite the fact that, in my view, and also in the view of people like Cardinal Danneels, the Cardinal Archbishop of Brussels, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, the Archbishop of Westminster, which is the Catholic Archdiocese that covers Greater London, despite the fact that people like Cardinal Carlo Maria Martini, the former Archbishop of Milan, that despite all of these distinguished theologians and extremely well-known Catholic leaders talking about the justification, the moral justification for the use of condoms, for instance, in trying to prevent the spread of AIDS, our church has still not come to grips with that issue. So on those kind of issues, in some ways, I suppose most Catholics either ignore the church or are even embarrassed by the stances that the church takes. But what we are starting to see, and this is a but that people really do need to take notice of, and this is one of the strengths that I see starting to emerge in the papacy of Benedict XVI, there is an increasing emphasis within the Catholic Church upon the necessity to protect and to care for the environment and the world around us. It started in a small way in the papacy, at the end of the papacy of John Paul II, but it's really been taken up in a big way by B16, as I like to call him, Benedict XVI.
Or you call him Eggs too, don't you?
Well, I think that's more your nickname for him, Eggs Benedict. But I like to call him B16.
Okay. He sounds like a B72.
Well, a B52. Yes,
52,
right.
Yeah. 52.
So, I'm also a bit of a plane buff, so. at any rate, B16, for instance, when he was here in Australia just 2 weeks ago, four of the seven major speeches he gave, an important component of each of those speeches was a strong reference to the environment and to the necessity to protect the environment. The simple reality is that within the Catholic tradition, there has always been a suspicion about capitalism. Capital, right from the time of Pope Leo XIII at the end of the 19th century, in his great encyclical Rerum Novarum, there has been a critique of capitalism within Catholicism. And I think that there is a very, very clear link between capitalism and environmental degradation and destruction.
Yeah.
So I do think that we have the wherewithal within Catholic moral theology to be able to develop a critique of capitalism and also a critique of the consequences of kind of our monumental consumption in terms of its destructive effects on the environment. And that's certainly where my newfound friend B16 is coming from.
It's interesting, Paul. Is there any way that when they've worked this out, an edict could be sent from the Vatican and the Pope to look at all the churches just in the United States, let alone all over the world, for the priests from their pulpit to talk about and teach their congregations about environmentalism and the responsibility towards life on the planet?
Well, in some ways that's already happening. One of the things that has happened within Catholicism is that the religious orders, particularly the religious orders of sisters and brothers and priests, they have become more and more aware of the kind of environmental issues. One of the leading environmental thinkers, certainly within the Catholic tradition, but also much more broadly, he's very well known outside the Catholic tradition, is Thomas Berry. Now, Thomas Berry, who comes from North Carolina originally, but has spent much of his life in the New York area. Tom, who is
Is he a Trappist?
No, Tom Berry was a member of the Passionist Order, is a member of the Passionist Order, and is still very much a priest in good standing. But Tom really is a leading edge thinker in the environmental movement, but he's not, I suppose, so generally recognized as a Catholic, because his thought in some ways is so far in advance not only of Catholics, but of the general environmental movement. And so, in a way, down at the grassroots in the Catholic Church, already a lot of things are starting to happen. Now, you are right that you don't tend to hear very much about it from the pulpit. In many ways, I think the clergy, the diocesan clergy, might be a bit behind the game in this area. But certainly, once you have the Pope and the Vatican starting to take some leadership on this, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate this. It's not as though they've suddenly repudiated anthropocentrism and, you know, suddenly become kind of deep greenies and are ready to join Earth First or something. It's not that. That's not where they are. But they have travelled a considerable distance, and certainly I think they are open to travelling a lot further. And as I mentioned, I think the always lingering suspicion of rampant capitalism within Catholicism and of rampant individualism within Catholicism and overconsumption, it's those kind of issues that will, if you like, rebound and, I think, deepen the green tinge that the Pope and the Vatican are showing at present.
Well, if the Vatican was walking, or the Pope was walking in the shoes of the fisherman, what did he say about it's more difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel to pass through the eye of a needle, right?
Yes, for a person who professes to be an atheist, Helen, or a non-believer, you have a good knowledge of Scripture.
Well, I've been fascinated by it all my life. Tell us what are the main philosophical principles that Tom Berry professes.
Well, I mean, Tom, his thought is complex and multi-layered. But, I mean, if there's one thing I suppose that sums it up, and I wouldn't want to be oversimplistic about his thought, but if there is one thing that I think in a way does sum it up, he says that we humans have a great capacity to be sympathetic to genocide, to to murder, to killing of human beings. You know, we're very concerned about all of those things, but we have no consciousness of what he calls biocide, the slaughter of animals, the slaughter of species, the destruction of the world around us. That we have become, he says, that our religious traditions have made us so anthropocentric, and I think the critique that the historian Lynn White put out of Judeo-Christianity really back in the 50s and 60s, the kind of anthropocentrism, the kind of focus, the kind of sympathy and pathos of the human that we go on with endlessly without any sense of, if you like, the pathos of the suffering world around us, the suffering of animals, the destruction of plants and whole geographical areas. There's all this sympathy for the human, but we don't seem to have that sense of connection with the world. That's why I think that environment, going back to the environmental conversion thing, is so important, because once you have that sense of being connected with the world, then the pain of the world becomes real for you. So Tom is saying that we have to escape from the kind of prison that in some ways our religious traditions, not just Judeo-Christianity, I mean, all of the great religious traditions do in fact focus very much upon the human. I know that the Buddhists, claim to be far more environmentally aware, and there is some truth to that. But all religious traditions focus on the human. What we've got to do is to recover the focus that was there in the kind of at the base level of all our great traditions, where it was not just the human, but it was the human in relationship to the world around us.
Which is what the American Indian really had. You know, they wouldn't do anything to damage nature before they thought of the consequences to the next seven generations. Of course, that's still anthropocentric in a way.
Well, the interesting thing is, and it was actually Tom Berry who himself is an expert on a Native American religion, and he led me to do a little reading in that area. And one of the things that I found most impressive was the way in which that Native American religion endowed personhood on all of the realities in the natural world, that that animals and even inanimate objects in the natural world were endowed with a sense of personhood. Now, again, perhaps some people listening to this will recall a quite famous Catholic thinker, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who is a French Jesuit paleontologist. And he also is deeply influential on Tom Berry. But de Chardin saw that the whole of creation, the whole of evolution, was a process of moving toward consciousness. And he included inanimate as well as animate and sentient beings within that development. And I think as we come to learn, especially to see more and more about, to see animals, and to see animals in their native state in action, we start to realize that they have clearly, clearly the higher animals have consciousness, they clearly have an awareness of themselves. In some of the higher species, there are clear traces in their social interactions of kind of, if you like, almost an ethics. And so it seems to me that Teilhard's notion that consciousness is a constantly evolving reality, and that, you know, I suppose all that we could say about ourselves is that we are the most consciously conscious of all beings. I mean, it seems to me that within that kind of a context, to come back to where we started in this somewhat convoluted piece of verbiage, to come back to the Native Americans, they're bestowing upon objects in the environment, both sentient and non-sentient, a sense of a personhood seems to me to make a lot of sense within that context. And I think it's only as we start to recover these kind of things that we will kind of move in the direction of really treating the world with more respect.
And love.
And love, exactly.
Well, I'm interviewing Paul Collins, an ex-priest, obviously an Australian by his accent. Paul, when you talk about the Native American Indians, of course our Aboriginal population in Australia confer upon, you know, rocks and creeks and riverbeds some sort of personhood too in their dream time and song lines. They are as conscious, I think, as the Native American Indians, right?
Well, no, yes, I think that's absolutely correct. I have, you know, the reality is that Indigenous people, I mean, I don't want to idealize Indigenous people. I do think there is a tendency among the, if you like, progressive elite in most Western countries, a tendency to idealize Indigenous people and to turn them into kind of, a resurrected noble savage of Rousseau. I dealt with Australian Aborigines and interacted with them, and, you know, they're just normal human beings, actually. I don't see them necessarily as the repositories of, you know, the greatest wisdom the world has ever known. I don't see them that way. But what I do think that they have is that they have a sense of the incipient consciousness in the whole of the landscape. They understand that the landscape speaks of more than itself, that the landscape has an element of transcendence within it. They intuit that, they understand it. What has happened to us is that living in our cities, we have become so urbanized, cut off from genuine and real landscape. Certainly in Australia, but also in the United States, as I said, imagine what the Michigan landscape used to be like before industrialization.
Well, what does it look like now? You haven't painted a verbal picture of what you saw in Michigan that so affected you, Paul.
I saw a very much a farmed and managed landscape. There's certainly, it's very productive land. I suppose I was, as we say in Australia, gobsmacked by, in other words, surprised, by the productive nature of the land there, because, you know, there's so much topsoil, whereas in Australia, topsoil is so thin and our landscape is extremely difficult one to work in terms of agriculture. But I saw a landscape that had been, you know, heavily and highly farmed and highly productive, so that essentially, and see, this is what it's hard for us to get into our heads. Agriculture is a form of industry. You know, it is about using the land for its productive values. It does not respect, in the end, it doesn't respect its natural values.
Mm.
And so I saw an industrialized landscape, just as, you know, farming is a form of industrialization, just as you see exactly the same thing in Europe or in Britain. It's a farmed industrial landscape. But what I also saw there was the pollution, specifically I saw of Lake Erie, and I know that whole area now has been cleaned up quite radically, but I was thinking about it in terms of around places like Toledo, Ohio, a town that's been through some pretty hard times, but just the pollution of Lake Erie, for instance, the loss of fish species, just the way in which the water table in the whole area has been poisoned by chemicals.
Mm.
I mean, these are the things I'm really talking about. The way in which, as I said, towns like Flint have become kind of industrial deserts, totally dependent on one or a couple of corporations, or one or perhaps two industries. I mean, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about.
Yeah, which are now going under because they steadfastly refused to build autos that were more fuel efficient, and now people won't buy the stuff. And, you know, the Japanese companies with Priuses and Toyotas and Honda hybrids, etc., are scooping the market, and they've brought it upon themselves in a way. But what I want to say to you, Paul, or ask you, as a deeply spiritual man, obviously, this is Paul Collins from Australia, an ex-priest, do you think, realistically, looking at it, do you think we've got time to get people to have their ecological conversion and to do the right thing? And surely the Vatican, I mean, do they understand the urgency of the issue? That, you know, I interviewed James Hansen last week from NASA, who's the leading meteorologist in the world and who coined the phrase global warming 20 years ago, and he says it's almost too late. What I want to know from you as a Catholic and a deeply spiritual man and understanding ecology, do you think we have time to raise the human race in an evolutionary way to understand spiritually and intellectually and emotionally what on earth we're doing to the earth?
Well, as a human being with his feet on the ground, I'd have to say I don't think we have time. I've thought that for in the last decade or more.
Mm.
I think that time has already run out.
Mm.
And what I also think is modern capitalist neo-rationalist economics has created the gargantuan mess, a mess created by monumental stupidity, the gargantuan mess that we're in now. And what do? We say, oh, we have to go into carbon trading in order to get out of this. In other words, we fall back on the benighted, already bankrupt, already monumentally, you know, we can see as monumentally stupid economics that that we've lived with for the most of the 20th century and for much of the 19th, and now into the 21st. So, as a human being, as you know, abstracting from any form of Christian faith, let me simply say, I think we are such a stupid group of people. And history, you know, if there is history after us, then they will see us as one of the, you know, really as of a number of generations who have constituted the most rapacious and ugly group of humans who have ever inhabited the planet. And I say that fully conscious of what I'm saying, and I'm saying it about someone who lives within this system as I do. However, I think if you just say that, well, you may as well now all switch off your radios and, you know, eat, drink and be merry for, you know,
tomorrow
for sure,
die.
Tomorrow you'll be dead.
Yep.
We will be exactly like Russia, Tsarist Russia in 1916. We will be hiding the truth from ourselves that the regime was finished and our economic regime is finished and it is not the solution to our problem. However, I also come to this as a Christian and a Catholic. And at the essence of, I have always believed that love is not the essence of Christianity. I believe hope is the essence of Christianity. That, if you like, faith and love are the products of hope. And hope is profoundly associated with the human imagination.
Mm.
A person who can imagine a different world, a person who can imagine, not this world, but another world, another possible world, still has hope. And at times, I have to admit that my hope is very close to despair, but at the same time, I refuse to give up on hope. And as a believing Catholic Christian, I also would say that this is God's earth. I mean, that was the title of my book in 1995. It was a purposely chosen title, and the subtitle was Religion as if Matter Really Mattered.
Mm.
And that I do think that matter matters, because at the core of Christian belief is a belief in the incarnation of God. That is, that God assumed the human condition and entered into existence on this earth, so that for God, this earth must be extraordinarily valuable. And so while I don't believe that God is going to save us from our stupidity by some type of direct, mad, charismatic intervention, I do believe that God will not allow us to destroy the earth completely. And I do believe that while humankind may not necessarily have a future, although I hope to God it does, I do firmly believe that the earth has a future and might well breathe a sigh of relief when we go.
Well, I've always said that, you know, we're the pathological microbes on the planet producing the death and destruction of many of the Earth's species and nature. And I do think that, but I also do believe, and that's what you were really talking about, the higher spiritual nature of humans. And as I've watched people on their deathbeds, or as their children are dying and they fall into my arms, I see their beauty, the beauty of the soul with which they're born. And I know inside everybody is that extraordinary purity and beauty, which can be tapped into at any and all times.
Yes, and you, like yourself, I've been to more deathbeds than most, being a priest and for a while a hospital chaplain at one stage in a large public hospital.
Mm.
So I've seen a lot of people die and die quite often traumatically.
Mm.
And I do think that is absolutely right, that there is amazing potential within humankind, amazing potential. The other thing I would say is that I'm a historian by training, essentially a historian, I think. I tend to view the world in a very historical way. And the thing that we never take into account is serendipity. We don't take into account that the change can occur extraordinarily rapidly and can lead to very, very different situations. I've been to more conferences on global warming than I care to think about, and I've listened to more pessimistic scientists than I care to think about, and I do think that they are utterly realistic and talking sense, and that it's our political leaders who are the people who have absolutely no sense whatsoever, apparently. But at the same time, I do think that people like ourselves have got to keep a kind of sense of hope alive, a sense that there are other possibilities, and that we have to, in a way, hope against hope sometimes, and just really keep at it. And I'm certainly going to go down fighting on it. And I think that there are lots and lots of people around who feel exactly the same way. And that gives me hope.
I agree. And I think with hope and optimism, we can all become leaders, actually, in our own areas. Some great national leaders, some international leaders, some leaders in their own parishes, in their own communities. But we have to rise up, turn off our television sets, which absolutely inculcate and brainwash us with more corporatism and capitalism, and get out there and really fix things, right?
Absolutely. And keep the radio on, because you might hear Helen Caldicott speaking.
Sometime. Or Paul Collins. Paul, I want to get back to the Catholic Church, because it's always sort of kind of fascinated me and made me a bit scared. What?
It's a paper tiger, Helen.
Yeah, no, worry. No, it's not. Because what is this stuff about birth control? I have to tell you that when I was a practicing doctor, the people who came to me first for an abortion, wanting an abortion, were either Catholic women who were pregnant with a man who wasn't their husband, or whose daughter had become pregnant, you know?
Yep.
And so it's okay to sort of mouth it, but in practice they... So why are they so opposed to birth control and condoms in an age of AIDS, and even abortion? What's this about?
The vast majority of priests in the United States, Canada, Australia, in the English-speaking world, in Europe, the vast majority of priests simply have never in their lives ever told any woman or any couple what to do.
Oh,
now,
really?
There are priests who think it is their business to interfere in other people's lives. But never, I mean, I can truly say, honestly, never once in 33 years of the priesthood did I ever hector anybody about sex, let alone presume to ask people questions or give them advice about their personal lives. And the simple reality is that I do know the statistics for Australia. I don't know them for the United States. But the simple reality is that Catholic fertility in Australia at the present moment is marginally lower than national fertility. Mm. And the other interesting thing is that the mix, as we call them, the Catholics, have never been all that stupid, because, in fact, some research has shown that in the latter part of the 19th century and throughout the 20th century, before, say, the modern era of the Catholic Church, from the 1960s onwards, research has shown that Catholic fertility was never more than 1% higher than average fertility in Australia. So, and I don't think Australia is our typical. I would think that's probably also true of the United States, although, you know, I stand open to correction on that, because I simply don't know the evidence, but I'm just guessing and extrapolating the Australian situation. But the simple reality is that Catholics are not fools. They don't run off to priests to ask necessarily to get advice as to what they should do. They might have to a certain extent in the past, but we shouldn't kid ourselves that they did too much of it.
But Paul, where does that doctrine come from? What I don't understand.
Right.
In the church.
It's quite an interesting story, and it's a story that's been told extremely well by an American writer, Robert Blair Kaiser. Mm. Bob Kaiser is a layman who wrote a book about the history of the birth control encyclical Humanae Vitae of 1968. And the simple reality is that the decision on birth control was not made on the basis of the morality of contraception. The decision was made on the basis of consistency in papal teaching. In 1932, Pope Pius XI had issued an encyclical called Casti Connubii, in which all forms of contraception were condemned. Paul VI, in the late 60s, set up a committee to advise him about contraception, and specifically about the pill, which, of course, had just been invented. I think it had been the product of the work of Dr. John Rock and a number of others in Boston, if I'm not mistaken. And he, Paul VI, set up a committee to advise him. That committee advised him that there was nothing wrong with the use of the contraceptive pill. However, a small group, interestingly, of cardinals and priests, among whom was an American Jesuit, Father John C. Ford, and in some ways it was Ford above all who put it to Paul VI that if he were to allow contraception, he would be contradicting his predecessor and would therefore run the risk of making papal teaching look like it was inconsistent.
Mm.
Now, that is the you know, in many ways, the key to the issue.
How interesting.
Now, Ford is an interesting character. When he returned to the United States, he was teaching at Western Theological Faculty in Boston, in Massachusetts. Ford was actually booed by the Jesuit students because they knew that he had been, partly responsible for Humanae Vitae. What they forgot was that John C. Ford, to his credit, was one of the few moral theologians who stood up during the Second World War and publicly condemned the carpet bombing of Germany, because carpet bombing was totally outside Catholic moral teaching with regard to war, because it was a deliberate and direct attempt to destroy the civilian infrastructure and to kill civilians. And Ford was one of the few people in the Western world, let alone in the United States, who had the courage to stand up and to say that. But this same John C. Ford became the man then who, in some ways, I don't want to exaggerate it, but in some ways was responsible for Humanae Vitae. And it's that question of the consistency of papal teaching that's at the core of the whole business.
Oh, well, I mean, obviously I got a little exercise just now when I talked about priests and the Catholic doctrine, but, you know, the truth is in the year 1800 there were 1 billion human beings, and by the end of the 20th century there were 5 billion, and now we're 6.6 billion. So we're increasing so exponentially that, you know, if the Catholic Church really did care about the environment and its numbers of people, as well as our capitalism and our destructive tendencies that are destroying the earth, that I think, and many environmentalists would say this, that we've got to control our reproductive instincts and in some very large and generic way.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. I mean, at the core of the environmental issue is not just capitalism, it's also population.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right, and I agree with that completely. The basic problem is that connection has not been yet made in Catholic moral theology. Hardly any Catholic moralist has discussed it.
Mm.
It is actually one of the complete inconsistencies and tragedies.
Yeah.
But you see, again, while I'm not trying for one moment to evade the responsibility of Catholics and the Church in this area, again, you do need to recall that, as I said earlier, decisions about contraception, decisions about how many children you have, are often more influenced by economics and by social situations than they are by religious convictions. I mean, certainly the historical evidence that I've seen is that, people have children or don't have children, not so much to do with religion or kind of moral considerations as to do with the kind of educational opportunities there are for women, the control that women are able to have over their own bodies and their own reproduction, the kind of women who are freed from, you know, patriarchal and clan structures that place them in an oppressed position, you know, in relationship to men. It's all of those things, and you must take into account on this before. You know, while the Catholic Church can get a walloping, and it certainly deserves it, at the same time you have to admit that it's countries like Italy, Portugal, and Ireland that really populations are actually declining at a rate of knots. and they're all Catholic countries.
But then you can look at Latin America too.
Well, you can, but you need to be fairly careful about Latin America because you're dealing there, again, with a fairly patriarchal structure.
Yes.
And it will be interesting to see, you know, that kind of Hispanic patriarchal, you know, and I'm kind of, I don't want to rush in and offend Hispanic people here. But, the structure is relatively patriarchal.
Mm.
That, I think, has to be taken into account as well. I mean, one of the areas where your point is most vividly illustrated is in, say, a place like Kenya,
yes.
where, in fact, you know, the Catholic bishops, ought to be taken out and given a good shaking because they have been so stupid about, not facing up to the kind of problems created by Kenya's population explosion.
Yes, yes. Well, Paul Collins, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. In fact, we could talk for another 6 hours, I think, from many perspectives. I think the subjects we covered are some of the most important to be discussed on Earth today. So I want to thank you very, very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And I hope everyone will love Paul and his accent and what he represents. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Helen.
I've been speaking with Paul Collins, a historian, broadcaster and writer who's regarded as one of Australia's foremost intellectuals and commentators on cultural and religious affairs. Don't forget, if you'd like to support this program, go to our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org and there's a place there where you can donate and we'd be greatly appreciative. Information on Paul's books, go to www.cunnaneagency.com. And thank you for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and edited by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.